what we're doing is we're now actually in the last section of Bridges and Walls. We've been looking through the series. We've already done four parts of the series on the fifth and last part of this unit, and we've kind of witnessed the divisions and the extension of that division in the Northern Kingdom, so and the Southern Kingdom. So, in the south, we've witnessed Rehoboam, Abiam, and Asa. And then in the north, we've witnessed the unfolding of the dynasty of Jeroboam and Nadav, the obliteration of that dynasty, the arrival of Baasha and Elah, and the obliteration of that second dynasty. So that's sort of the expansion we've been witnessing through Parakim Yudalit, Tesvav, Teszayin. Now, at the very tail end of Teszayin, we actually encounter a degree of stability, a degree of so to speak, a level of serenity which has arrived through a very unusual character. So our focus this evening is understanding the person by the name of Omri. Omri is going to be an important name for us, and we're going to take a look at some of the very little we hear about him in Tanakh explicitly and try to piece together the picture. So as you may recall, the last time we left our heroes was when there was a rebellion against the house of Baasha, and the person by the name of Zimri, who was a captain of the cavalry, took advantage of his drunken king and kills Elah when he was drunk upon the floor in Tirzah, in the capital, and that ends the dynasty of Baasha. Every last person is wiped out. Well, unfortunately, those who live by the sword don't die peacefully at old ages, and this is particularly true of Zimri. So let's take a look at the five psukim about the interleading time here, and we're told the following. Bishnas esrim vosheva shana. We're in Perek Teszayin, Pasuk Tesvav to Yuchav. In the 23rd year, Laasa Melech Yehuda, Malach Zimri Shivas Yamim, Besirtsa, Va'am Chonim Al Gibson Asher Laplishtim. So he had a ripe rule of seven entire days. And meanwhile, the people are fighting, the Israelites are fighting against the Philistines at Gibeon, which is where this continual battlefield seems to happen. It's happened now for now, really over decades, it seems. There seems to be, the pasuk seems to be describing a divide between what we'll call, the Washington, D.C., the sort of this political capital, and where the war front is, the outposts. Vayishma ha'om hachonim lemor koshar zimri v'gam hikoyes ha'melech v'yamlichu kol Yisrael es omri sar tzevo al Yisrael b'yom ahu b'vachaneh. So people hear that Zimri has killed the king, and instead of saying, well, long live Zimri, they say, well, long live Omri, who's the sar tzevo, which is, Omri is the captain of the guard. Now, it's fascinating because that automatically means that there's divisions in the rank of the military. Because Zimri is the Sar Chatzi Arechev. Zimri is a military figure. But interestingly enough, this military figure was at the home office. He was on the home front guard. He wasn't at Gibson fighting the battle. It seems that the one who is in the battle, in the trenches with his soldiers, is the one that people actually prefer. And that's Omri. Vaya'ale Omri v'chol Yisrael imoim b'Gibson v'yatsuru ad Tirza. And they besiege Tirzah, which is the capital, where in fact Zimri has taken power. Vayhi kiros Zimri kinilkado ha'ir, when he sees that the city has been taken. Vayavoy el armon beis amelech, vayisrof olav es beis melech bo'esh, vayamos, he sets the palace of light, and thereby killing himself. A very ignoble death for a traitor. Va'al chato sova shechato, he died for the sins which he sinned. La sois hara be'enei Hashem, la leches b'derech Yeravam v'chato soy asher aso la'achtias Yisrael, because he went in the ways of his predecessor Yeravam to cause Israel to sin. V'yesedi rezimri v'kishra asher kashar, and the rest of his story and the rebellion that he instigated. Haloihem kesuvim al sefer divrei yamim l'malchei Yisrael. Read about it in the Chronicles of the Books of Israel. So there we have it. Okay, so here we have Zimri, we have his unfortunate end, and we have Omri marching on the capital. In general, in history, it is always interesting to notice when you have a situation where you have the king and you have the military general, and that's always a difficult dynamic. David HaMelech felt pinned. He felt paralyzed by Yoav and was not able to do certain things because of Yoav. Avner was a very powerful figure in the cabinet of Ishbosheth. We've seen this already in Tanakh. Here we have Omri, who's obviously much more powerful than the person who's taken the reins of kingship. The question that sticks out to me in this section is not so much the length of his rule. That makes sense, unfortunately. It seems, in fact, that Zimri has utilized his entire 7 days to completely wipe out Baasha's family, which was part of the prophecy. But more than that, no other achievements can really be amounted to. And if that's the case, one has to ask oneself, so why is he accused of all these sins? You know, look what it says here. It says in Pasuk Yotes, he has killed al chato sova asher chato, his sins. The man only had 7 days. And you can imagine a few of those days were spent defending Tirzah. So is that a fair assessment of the reason that he died? That seems to be a little bit troubling here. So interesting enough, the Mefarshim go in different directions. And I find each of these directions fascinating. The Radak, Rav David Kimchi, suggests the following, Lachtias Israel, I mean, give the man a chance. He hadn't ruled yet. Right? What could he possibly have done to cause Israel to sin? Rather, it must be, Koidim lakem, Shoyatsar machtis arechev, Hoya machti es Yisrael. It must be he already had a track record. It must be from the suggestion of the Pesukim, says the Radak, that he wasn't a nobody. He was a very powerful figure in the cabinet of the Northern Kingdom. And in his experience, his track record has always led to negative spiritual policies. That's why the Pasuk says, it talks about the rest of his matters, meaning the matters of his previous stage of life, when he was, so to speak, just a senator, right? Before he emerged as the king for 7 days. So this is not a new horse who's learning new tricks. This is a well-corroborated history of negative spiritual leadership. It comes to a fore when he becomes king, because now he has more access to be able to implement his policies. But in the end of the day, he already is in this difficult situation. So Radak says, "Is what's the Pesukim referring to? It's referring to the past and giving us a little bit of an inkling into the type of person that he already was." The Malbim says, "No, we need to reframe it in a different direction. If we sort of pivot the lens." He says, rather, Rotze lomar, what does it mean? Shegomar bedaato lasois veloleches bederech ze. It's not about the past, but it's about the future. That's a fascinating comment that the Malbim is making. The Malbim is almost saying that his aspirations were already becoming tangible. You know, Zimri takes over, he murders his drunk previous lord, and already he has edicts to be issued about the spiritual format and life of the nation of Israel, which we know are going to be bad. So therefore, this is why he's punished. Now, this is fascinating. This Malbim is an intriguing suggestion because it makes one think that there's a certain level of culpability based on the future, not the past. You know, for those, when I was growing up, it was a beautiful movie. Well, it's something which I really appreciated because of the philosophical underpinnings, called Minority Report. And it explores the idea of capturing people and putting people into jail based on future crimes. The idea that a person who premeditates a crime could be captured, that they would use children who came from terrible drug backgrounds, who had these visions, and they realized these visions were about crimes that were about to happen. And by tapping into the images in their mind, they could piece together cases of future crimes and arrest people. And the question became is, could you prosecute somebody based on an action they're about to commit? Like, how sure is it that you're able to pin down that attempted murder or that attempted theft? With just so to speak, the about-to-be-smoking gun. Just a fascinating concept in general. The Malbim is saying is that the cards are lined up enough over here to give us a pretty closed case that Zimri was going to be up to no good. In fact, I think that the Malbim and the Radak are actually two halves of the same coin, because a person who's lived such a life will probably carry on to live such a life. And that's what's being said about Zimri, which is why he was snubbed out before he had the chance to unfold any further negative policies. Okay, so this is fascinating. I think we should also just sort of put this on the back burner to think about, if this is the case when it comes to Zimri, That means that anybody who does make it through, like the Omris and the Achavs and the future kings, obviously weren't quite as bad as Zimri could have been. So that's a pretty terrifying suggestion about who Zimri could have been. Okay, be it as it may. Now we see, okay, so Zimri's dead. So at this point in time, you would say, well, Omri triumphantly walks in and everything should be just fine. Well, not quite. Because, Jews in general have this proclivity to disagree about most things. So it's interesting. So the next thing that happens is, Oz yecholeko om Yisrael lachetzi, chatzi om ayo achare tivne binginas, lam lechoy v'chatzi achare Omri. So now that you have this traitor is gone, so who do you put on the throne? Well, Omri was the one who besieged him. On the other hand, there's this other fellow called Tivni ben Ginas. Vayechezako om asher achare Omri, esa om asher achare Tivni ben Ginas. And so the one mob overpowers the other mob, and the one that was supporting Omri actually comes out on top. Vayomos Tivni vayimloch Omri. And Tivni dies, Omri takes his place. You know, that's obviously a bit of a curious pasuk. You know, if that were the headlines of the paper that week, what would you think? Tivni dies. Heir to the throne, contested monarch, dies. So what does that mean? You know, so how did that happen exactly? So the Radak makes two suggestions. He says that ma misas atzmeis misas atzmai. Right, so Kemesh Molach, Molach Omri, Beloi Machloikes. So maybe it simply is a description of fact. What seems to be going on over here, says the Radak, on the most basic level is, yes, unfortunately, he died at an early age, and that ended the dispute. We don't know how long this dispute was necessarily. We will because of the adding the years together later on, but it could be, you know, that it was ended by a premature death, a natural death of Tivni, and thereby this was resolved. However, it was Seder Olam Omer, and the Seder Olam, the Medrash. I'm sorry, can you not hear?
We couldn't hear you well.
The whole time, or just this last moment?
Just now.
Okay, so the Radak makes a suggestion that maybe it was a natural death, and if it's a natural death, then there's very little to be. Then he died with at a we'll call it an auspicious time to resolve this dispute. But there's another more intriguing suggestion, which he quotes the Medrash. The Medrash Seder Olam. If those are familiar, Seder Olam is the time frame Medrash. It's the Medrash gives us the time frame of history from Adam to Alexander. And we're told here, Omer ki hargoi tivni, kevon she'si asa bitoy shel Omri liyehoshaphat hargu es tivni. So there's actually a fascinating story, a subtext which is being played out here, and that is what happens. Asa, who is the king of Yehuda down south, marries the daughter of Omri to Yehoshaphat, which means, let's just sort of appreciate this, in the north there's chaos. There are two military figures. I'm assuming that at this point in time Tivni is also a military figure. So we have two figures vying for the throne. The nation is split under each of them. There's stability in the south under Asa. Asa is a very long-living king. He's a righteous king for the most part. And he decides to marry his daughter. He's going to take the daughter of Omri and marry the daughter into his family, to his son Yehoshaphat. Now, that's a very powerful moment in history, if you think about it. Because what's essentially happening now is Asa is choosing sides. Asa is saying, out of the two contenders, I prefer Omri as the opportunist, as the potential ruler, so much so that I'm going to even put my hat in the ring to such a degree by merging the families. This becomes essentially, if you think about it, the first bid towards a united kingdom. That's a very, very powerful idea which is happening now, which means that embedded in these psukim over here, according to this medrash, is that the death of Tivni was as a result of the scales of power being tipped, not within the kingdom of Israel, but within the kingdom of Yehuda, leaning in to this machlokes. That's a very, very fascinating suggestion. Let's follow that suggestion up and see if it has any play or bearing in the text itself. So let's meet Omri himself. We don't know so much about him besides the fact that he did fight against Zimri. We're only told a few psukim. We're told from psukim Chav Gimel to Chav Ches. That's it. We have about Omri. Bishnas shloshim va'achas shana le'osa melech Yehuda malach Omri al Yisrael. Shteim esrei shana besirza malach malach b'sheishanim. Okay, so we're told that he now takes the rule again. Asa is the longer living king. Because he's a longer living king, here's the reference point of years for Omri. And we hear now about the 12 years, 6 years after Tirza, right? So because there's this amount of time that it's a split kingdom, and then it's a time of being a full kingdom. Vayiken es hahar Shamron, he acquires the hill in Samaria, me'es Shemer, from a man by the name of Shemer, bechik rayim kesef, with 2 talents of silver, it's a large amount of money. Vayiven es hahar, he built on this mountain, vayikra es shem ha'ir, Asher bana es shem Shemer Adonai Har Shamron. So he called the area or the territory Shamron based on the owner of the hill. So if, in case you're wondering, you know, we talk about Judah and Samaria. Judah and Samaria is based on the city called Shamron. The city of Shamron is based on the person who owned that hilltop, whose name was Shemer, which is why it is called Shamron. Just the history of this place. Vayaseha Omri Harabinea Shemvayara Mikol Asher Lafonav. He did worse than all his predecessors, which is saying quite a lot. Vayelech Bechol Derech Yeravam Ben Nevato Vachatasa Asher Tis Israel Achis Hashem Elokei Yisrael Bahavlehem. And he caused tremendous amount of sin in Israel through his vanities. And finally, Vayeser Divrei Omri Asher Aso Gvurosa Asher Aso Halahim Kesovim. I'll say for Divrei Yomim Malchi. So I want to find out more. Read the Chronicles of the Books of Israel. And he's buried in Shamron. And his son Achav, who we're going to spend a lot of time with, rules in his stead. It's interesting to note that it's almost as if the shift of the capital of the north has moved from Tirza to Shamron, because now he's choosing it not just to be an important city, but also the burial plots of the kings. That should be noticed as well. Just to get a sense of where we are, where we stand, Shamron is really the area to the west of the Har Eval, Har Gerizim, Shechem area. It's pretty center of the area of the of Judah and Samaria. It is interesting to note that it was called later on, as given as a gift in the first century to Augustus, and it was called Sebastia. And that should be familiar to us, because in the Hit Yashvut, in the resettlement, it's important to use the word re, because when the Jews came home to the heartland of Israel in post the 1967 war, one of the first outposts was Sebastia. Okay, just to appreciate what it was. This is a picture over here of what it looked like in 1925. There was maybe, they say, a few hundred Arabs who lived around the area then, but that's that ruins, these famous pillars are sort of one of the symbols of the area of Samaria. It was repopulated many, many times by many different people. In fact, the picture at the very top here, this is another picture of Sebastia or Shamron, the city. Okay, you obviously saw the contemporary and the ancient merging in this picture. Very, very fascinating from the Roman times as well. So this is what he has achieved. So a few basic questions to understand over here is that, you know, like, so how bad was it? What does it mean he went further than everybody before him? The Ralbag says, Yidme shalach b'chata'as yiravam k'mo shesiper v'oisiv oid lach to chata'im acherim. He introduced new undone sins yet. V'efshar od, sh'amar sh'arami kol asher lofona b'bnei lechtoi b'chol chata'as yiravam ki haya ra'ui she'kabel musar b'bnei ma she'ro'a mi'beis ba'asho u'beis yiravam. U'lefi sh'la kibel klal me'a musar m'pnei zeh, Lehair Maat Mechata Asiravam, Hine Ra'ui Shemar Sharami Kol Asher Lafonov. Says the Ralbag, it doesn't mean to say necessarily that he introduced new negative reforms or regulations in society. But in fact, status quo is worse. Meaning, if you were in the shoes of Omri, and you'd seen what happened to the house of Yeravam, and you saw what happened to the house of Baasha, and they both got prophetic messages, one from Achia Ashiloni, one from Yehu, and in both those cases, both the prophecies came true because of their policies, their spiritual policies, At this point in time, Omri should be in a pretty 2020 vision perspective to know that this is not the correct way to be carrying on. And the fact that he does not change, the fact that he stays calcified in the same position, ultimately is what makes it worse. Because he has the retrospect, which they didn't, and he continues doing it. So that's something which is worthwhile thinking. So rather than amounting and sort of trying to find worse things that he did, ultimately it's important to appreciate that status quo is always a terrible thing. Now, we don't hear much about Omri. If you go back to those psukim we just looked at, we hear really the only distinguishing factor about him is this buying of this Satir Shamran. We don't hear too much about that marriage which was mentioned. We don't hear too much about anything else except for the fact that he carried on the sins and he was buried. Dina, yeah.
When you move, something happens to the microphone when you move. So sometimes you kind of fade out.
That's interesting. Okay, thank you for that. So you know what? I will try to scroll.
See this? Okay. I don't know what it is, but I thought maybe you would want
to
know.
Thank you. I'll scroll at a separate time. You know, internet is always a fascinating thing when it works and a frustrating thing when it doesn't work. So it's interesting here to actually make the comparison. Now, we're going to use Divrei HaYamim. We've been using Divrei HaYamim very richly when looking at the Sefer Melachim. It's usually only helpful when we're looking at the southern kingdom, because Divrei HaYamim, our book of chronicles of Ezra and Nehemiah, is not going to be helpful for the northern kingdom that we're dealing with now, because the northern kingdom was not the interest of Ezra. He was not interested in linking the northern kingdom, which was seen as, so to speak, a detour. So he doesn't talk about it so much. However, whenever you have something to do with the northern kingdom that intersects the southern kingdom, it is relevant. So in Divrei HaYamim Beis, Perek Yod Ches, we do hear this story. Vayhi Yehoshaphat Osher v'chavod l'rov v'yischatein l'achav. So Yehoshaphat, who's going to be the king of the south, the son of Asa, is going to have a lot of riches and success, and is marrying into the family of Achav. That's what the Medrash is talking about. The Seder Olam was based on this pasuk that we're talked about here. And here, in fact, is the Seder Olam Rabbah. It's in Yud Zion, where it describes exactly this. Bishnas lamed aleph la'asa malach omri malchus shlemo vayachazak ha'om ibnei ma hargu es tivni. Why did they kill Tivni? Kevon shenasa asa bitoy shel omri liyehoshaphat benoy liisha hargu es tivni. When Asa leaned in, making this marriage union between the north and the south, that was when Tivni was sidelined, and when he was sidelined, he lost his support and ultimately was assassinated. But the Medrash continues. This is the part that Rashi does not quote. Omar Rebbe Yossi, v'chi efshar leben shiyahe gadol me'aviv kishtei shanim, elo kevon shiyasi asa es benoy lebitoy shel omri, nigzera gezera al malchus beis David shetichle im beis Achav. In fact, it was seen as a negative thing that once Asa marries his son Yehoshaphat to the daughter of Omri, at that point in time, there was a certain decree upon the house of David that it would fall with the house of Achav. V'cheinu Omer, we're going to see a little bit later on, u'me'elokim ho'esa tevusas Achaziyahu v'goymer, v'naflu shneim bo'bayom ze im ze. We're going to see the king of the south and the king of the north will be murdered on the same day. We'll see that. That's going to be a very interesting story later on, when we get to Divrei HaYamim and later on Melachim. Why is it there's going to be the concurrent destruction of the kings of the south and the north? Because of their cooperation. Now that's fascinating, because you would think that any attempt to make the north and the south work together would be a laudable achievement. After all these years of civil war and strife, you would say anybody who's willing to put their money where their mouth is about connectivity and working together and building these bridges, that would be a positive effort. But apparently not so. Apparently it was not ripe yet. Apparently he was too open. He was too willing to accept the complexity of the north without the walls. You can't build the bridge without a degree of a wall being there. And that's what the Midrash seems to be focusing on. Now, let's put ourselves in Asa's place. What about Omri would he see that he believes is sufficiently good in potential to make that bridge and really even go so far as to uniting the kingdoms? Because remember, at this point in time, there are two contenders to the northern throne, Omri and Tivni, and he chooses one of them. What about him was so special? So we do see a critique about Omri, but what was it that was unique about him that perhaps gave him this right? The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us an interesting, interesting insight. The Gemara is on Daf Kuf Beis Amud Beis, and it says, Omri Rabbi Yochanan, Mipnei ma zacha Omri l'malchus. Why was it that Omri reached Malchus? Now, by the way, this is really asking the same question that the Seder Olam has answered. The Seder Olam has said, what made him get kingship was Asa allowing his daughter to marry his son, right? So that shifted the political scales. But the Gemara is asking it on a more spiritual level, saying not what was the political event which precipitated this, what was the spiritual political event which precipitated this? Mipnei shehoisif krach echad be'eretz Yisrael. He added a city to Israel. Shenemar vayiken es hahar shamron me'es shemer b'kichrayim kesev vayiven es hahar vayikra shem ha'ir asher bana shem shemer adonai ha'ar shamron. Quote in the pasuk we just learned, because he added a new city to Israel. And this Gemara is so interesting, because you have to understand this for just a moment. This is in the heartland of Judea, right? Of Samaria, or what's going to be called Samaria after it. It's not like he's making a new frontier. He's not sort of, you know, picking up the border fence and moving it 10 meters to the east. He is actually just conquering central land Samaria, and making it more established, more as a fortified area. But even that itself is seen as something very laudable. In fact, we don't just know about this internally, we know externally as well that Omri was a very powerful and very, what we'll call, formidable enemy in terms of conquering the land of Israel. And this is something we haven't seen for a long time. We saw David HaMelech's expansionism, which was incredible, and he expanded the boundaries of Israel to biblical promised lands. But since then, we haven't really seen that. Shlomo HaMelech consolidated and he lost, and then Rehavam lost even further and tried to consolidate. We saw one or two small, you know, skirmishes here and there. But up to now, we haven't seen this type of leadership yet reemerge. We actually have a copy. We can see, if anybody is able to go to the Louvre today in Paris, one is able to actually see what's called the Meisha Stele. Meisha Stele is a very remarkable piece of stone, because first of all, it's a fascinating story as to how in the 1860s, archaeologists were able to recover it and was broken in the process of being recovered. It essentially is a stele. A stele means a stone, a standing stone, with a cuneiform inscriptions upon it of the words of Mesha. Who is Mesha? Well, Mesha tells himself he is the king of Moab. Here, with a bit of reconstruction, R is the English translation of that cuneiform which Mesha wrote. Now, Mesha, we're going to meet later on. We're going to see him explicitly in Tanakh in just a few prokins' time. He is one of the kings of Moab, and he lives in the southeast of Israel. See, as all we're told, I am Mesha, son of Kamoshgad, king of Moab the Dibonite. Now, by the way, Kamosh is their deity. Okay, so the Tanakh talks about Kamosh numerous times. So, you know, these folks, demigod is the kind of word you're looking for. They view themselves very importantly. Right, my father reigned over Moab for 30 years. I've reigned after my father, and I've built the sanctuary for Kamosh in Karkach, a sanctuary of salvation for his savior from all aggressors, and made me look upon mine enemies with contempt. Omri was king of Israel and oppressed Moab many during many days, and Kamosh was angry with his aggressions. His son succeeded him, and he also said, I will oppress Moab. His son is referring to Ahav. In his days, he said, let us go, and I will see my desire upon him and his house. And Israel said, I shall destroy it forever. Now, Omri took the land of Medva and occupied it in his day, and the lands of the days of his son for 40 years. And Kamosh had mercy on it in my time, and I built Baal-Meon, and therein the ditch, and I bought Kiriasayim. So you see the Mesha describing part of his platform for success, and we'll call it his spiritual success, is his ability to be able to reprise the conquests of whom? Of Omri himself. This is just really a fascinating thing to witness, because here we're witnessing real history. You can actually see here as the cuneiform is very, very explicit. It's very beautifully and clearly written. On there's the reconstructed area is the black area, and the brown is actually the pottery itself, which is the original. You can see the cuneiform, which is essentially using the reed to carve out these letter forms, and understanding using the Moabite, which is very similar to many of the Semitic languages, to reconstruct this. So you hear now of Omri. Omri, the idea of the conquest of Shomron was not simply an exception, but it was an indicator of the type of king that he was. He was a king who is deeply nationalistic. He was a king who believed strongly in Israel and its conquests and its pride, which is a very beautiful thing, which is amazing. So what the Gemara is essentially saying is, what were the grounds upon which, what were the foundations spiritually that Omri had the wherewithal to rule? Was his deep desire to conquer and to maintain the land of Israel from its enemies. By the way, notice Medeva over there is all the way out east. We're talking East Jordan. This is southeast territories. He was an extreme expansionist. That being the case, that was perhaps what Asa himself saw in Omri. He saw a very dedicated, a very strong warrior, and he wanted to unite the two kingdoms. However, at the same time, it was somewhat premature, because spiritually he was still, as the Ralbag said, still in the cruise control of the previous generations, despite the calamity that had befallen them. So it was premature for this bridging to be made, but nonetheless, this was what was going on. I remember, fascinatingly enough, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik has a beautiful essay where he talks about Zionism in general, and one of the comments that he made is that you'll see that there are many difficult and complex characters in Tanakh. Later on, we're going to see a person by the name of Yerovam ben Yoash. Another example here is Omri. People who are Rishoim, people who were bad people spiritually speaking, and bad leaders in many ways, but at the same time, they had a zchus. They had a merit. Why? Because of their deep-seated nationalistic bent. The fact that they cared so much about the land of Israel. Aaron Soloveitchik pointed out that one should certainly learn from Tanakh, a very important lesson over here, that when reading the history of our people, you know, sometimes we have this illusion that it's only going to be the greatest tzaddikim who are going to be the leaders who are going to reinstate the land of Israel. And that's simply not the case. It just isn't. And Tanakh is emphasizing this over here, so much so that King Asa himself felt it appropriate to embrace and to create a relationship with Omri. And we're going to see perhaps the fruit of this labor and some of the successes which are created through the Ahav Yehoshaphat relationship and some of the failures which are created through that. It seems interesting that also later on, as we're going to see in Perikov Beis, we're going to see the same story is going to follow out through Ahav, as we're told there in Source 9. V'yesed divrei Ahav achol asher asol beis hashayin asher bananis. This ivory house which he built for himself for kol ha'arim asher banah halahim k'suvim al sefer divrei yom l'malchei Yisrael. He made all these cities. Meaning to say, Ahav took a feather out of his father's hat, and it was with this moment that there was a turning point. It wasn't a self-focused nation. It was a nation expanding outwards and expressing success. Military success, which hopefully would have been followed with spiritual success as well, which unfortunately was not to follow. And that leads us to the complex era of Ahav and his spiritual leader, Eliyahu HaNavi, which is going to be our next stop. So we're finishing now the series of bridges and walls, the attempts to make bridges, the complexity of those walls, and God willing, now we're about to start the next fascinating section in Tanakh, which is Eliyahu HaNavi.